what we want to do today is there's been a lot of opportunity to learn about David Bates and about his career through different programs, interviews, lectures throughout the two exhibitions, and I think many of you have had an opportunity to hear one or many or all of those. So whereas I think you will pick up on a lot of information about the artist, David, and about his career, I really, really want us to look at and think about and talk about the work, because we're in the galleries with it. There's no reason not to, right? So, but I also think that part of this exhibition, as is the case with the Nasher, I hope all of you know that this exhibition is between two museums, which is so spectacular and so unusual, and I hope we find occasion to do it again. It's been a huge success. Jeremy Strick said that part of his motivation, a little part, but at least some part of his motivation, was that he kind of heard that Dallas and Fort Worth didn't mix, and so he wanted to give people a reason to travel back and forth to see. It's really not a big deal. We can all do it. The payoff is great. You know, both cities have a lot to offer, so we should be taking full advantage. So thank you to David Bates for giving us an occasion for that. But while we're here, in addition to talking about the works individually, and because of the way it's installed, there will be some conversation about different series or work that happens under one subject matter and then moves on to another or media. I also think it'll be important to talk about and to look at the installation. I mean, that's something that when David walked in the first day, that was one of the first things we talked about, is how what are already big paintings look so much bigger in this exhibition, and why is that? And then also just those relationships, you know, like what are these paintings saying to each other? A good example being the Katrina paintings hung with the Gulf Coast paintings. It's actually, not only does it look good together, it's super profound. I mean, it's really profound what happens when you look at those two subjects together. So I think most of you know, because you probably have been following David for a long time or following this exhibition, and with that, David, you know that David was trained, I mean, he grew up in Garland, and he was trained undergraduate at Eastfield, I think, mm-hmm. and then went to SMU. And then after, after the undergrad, he was recognized as being somewhat special by plenty of people, but for one, Roger Winter, It was one of his mentors who really took an interest and saw that he had something special going on, and he was accepted into the Whitney Independent Study Program. That is no small feat. That's a huge deal. And I'd say that 3/4 of the artists that I asked to come and be a part of our lecture series, who are artists of some note, so many of them, 3/4 probably at least, have been through the Whitney Independent Study Program. And it is a mark of something, somebody special, a mark of success. But I think that David, in that process, recognized some things which you probably know about himself, and with that decided to come back to Dallas. And when he came back to Dallas, he really realized how much he loved art history, started taking art history courses, got his graduate degree at SMU, but in the process he also started teaching. Teaching did a couple of things. He taught some art history classes, so it put him deeper, because we all know the best way to learn something is to teach it, right? So it put him in that practice of teaching, which was also this practice of learning. And but the other thing that teaching did for him is it gave him an income, so he could make the art he wanted to make. He wasn't dependent on making a living through his work. Every artist needs that freedom. You know, it goes back to Virginia Woolf. Every artist, every writer needs a room of their own and $500 a month. Maybe it's a little more than $500 a month now, but it's a concept that still works. So what I want to do is I want to start with this painting, and then I'm going to kind of turn it over to David. I'm just going to insert on occasion, as you can tell just from this introduction. I like to take the long way home, and so does David. So I'm going to try to keep us on track with my timepiece here so that we can get through the entire exhibition. Of course, when David came back to Dallas, it is of note that that didn't mean that he left what was is and has always been, I guess, since World War II, considered the center of the art world, New York. He didn't so much leave it, or it didn't leave him, in that he continued to have gallery representation there. He has work in the Metropolitan, the Whitney, the MoMA. He was in the 1987 Whitney Biennial. So sometimes he makes light of the fact that he's just happy to be living here in Dallas and just making art as a Dallas artist. We all know better. So anyway, I think with that, let's move over here, David, and talk. I just want to ask you a couple questions about this.
First off, I'd just like to say that I thought I had pretty much worn out my welcome, but I'm glad to see that that there's still some people that I haven't talked to yet. I think that for me, you know, this kind of show and this kind of hanging of this show is so generous. The paintings like that Ed Walker painting in there on that giant wall, when Michael Opping was hanging it. You know, he said, "Oh, this is what I'm planning on doing." I said, "We need some more paintings in here, bro. You know, this is like, that's." And he goes, "You wait and see." So we put it up, and I think the difference is, one time you go to the Met, always expecting everything. You know, you know that's your goal. But I saw Sean Scully show at the Met one time, and they put them about this far apart, and that was too close. You know, I mean, it was like you couldn't concentrate on it. And I think that the kind of generosity that this museum, I mean, first off, it's an amazing building. We kind of take it for granted sometimes, but, you know, this is, when you say, well, he had a show at his local museum, yeah, it's not the usual local museum, and neither is the Nasher. But anyway, the space and generosity and beauty of the building, along with the way these things happen to look in here, it's never going to look any better than this. This is it. I can go to my grave now. I can go on now knowing that this was about as good as it's ever going to get. I mean, really, I've seen other shows in other spaces, and I didn't even think about that at the time. You know, when this was just coming over here, it was great. It was terrific. But now seeing this kind of thing, it is, it's really, it's such an honor to have this. I mean, this is what every artist, you know, hopes to have happen sometime in their life before they're this way. You know, so anyway, this kind of painting, I went over to the Kimball before I got over here earlier today, just a little bit earlier, to see a Van Rysdale storm painting. There's a storm painting over there that I saw last time I was over there and didn't get a chance to see it enough. And tomorrow I leave to go to Cleveland to see a Van Gogh, all these Van Gogh, like all the Postman paintings and all the bedroom paintings. And so I live this. I mean, this is like my idea of fun is Cleveland. I don't know. I've never been to Cleveland, so it may be awesome. I'm thinking it's going to be awesome. Right, Beth? Totally awesome. But you know, I'm just going, it's going to be rainy and cold and all the stuff. I won't be in it. I'll just go be in that museum all day long. It's a geeky kind of... it's either that or I'm out in that hurricane. It's like two realities. Either I want to be out in the hurricane where the storm's going on and live in that whole thing because I feel like that really feeds, that Hemingway experience really feeds the paintings. Or I want to be studying the other guys and gals that have all done that stuff and kind of learn from those. So between those two inputs of the painting and the reality of it, you know, that Terry was just looking at a Bellini that's over there, not the kind you drink, but the other kind.
I made the comparison.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Of that painting. And there's a Piero della Francesca that has a resurrection figure with that guy in it. I mean, it's not, I saw that guy, of course, fishing, but when I'm painting it, I'm looking at it as I'm painting this thing, and I'm thinking, this looks familiar for some reason, and it's that painting. He has a helmet on in that painting, and the light from the resurrection is blinding him, but it's that kind of thing. And the shirtless figure, you know, the thing is, it's not that I go around like, hey, dude, can you take your shirt off? It's more, it's more what I'm trying to show is some sort of two things. When you don't have so much clothes, it kind of locks it down to not being a particular time. If you see Edwardian clothes, it's probably Edwardian time period, or togas, unless it's a toga party, it's probably that period. So without a lot of clothes, you don't have that kind of, it's not a mark to a particular moment. And it also has a lot to do with the vulnerability of a person, a man against nature, even more vulnerable than you normally would be.
Okay, but you have to go look at the Christ blessing by Bellini, because it's the one that has been restored, because they actually had painted his drape up because it was a little too revealing, and then when they cleaned it, and it has the two little rabbits, but that it has the staff. I mean, I know exactly the one you're talking about, and I know that soldiers, so that makes more sense. But it'll kind of set you back. I just went over there because I know those are David's tutors. So I thought, I'm going to go to the Kimball one more time before we have this talk and look, and it just blew me away. But can you talk about the fact that this is such, with the installation?
Oh, yeah.
What do you make of that? That you come up the stairs, and this is what Michael Opping decided to put here, and you let him keep it there, so you must agree.
I got to say, with the hanging of this, everybody who hangs a show a number of times has a pretty good idea about their house, you know. And so usually when somebody's doing their house, I don't really get in the way. And Michael has done this place, and it looks great every time I've ever seen it hung. And so, you know, we talked over, Michael and Marla and I talked over different kinds of configurations. And when I came in, they already pretty much set things around. And you know, you walk up those stairs, you know, you need that, and the light comes down on you. They had some dinner downstairs for me one night. It was right at sunset, and I was in that, you know, that bar, and sunset came down between the buildings, and all of a sudden I lit up. I'm like, uh-oh, this is it. Yeah, I mean, the color of this room and the color of the it wasn't done for that, but it just has this real feeling of drawing you into that space. Really, you know.
Okay, you don't need me one bit, but I'm going to insert every chance I get, because one of the things I really want to talk about as we move through, I started catching on to this idea of portrait versus landscape versus still life. And there are a lot of things that should be a portrait that I read as landscape, and a lot of landscapes that are done in this portrait format. So I know that it's actually a portrait of the place. So as we go through, I'd like to talk about that, because that is definitely a portrait, and it's vertical, and we believe it to be a portrait. But look how horizontal. I mean, you've said everything you can say. Of course, that's a horizontal landscape. No way around it.
But the difference between Grassy Lake was first, when we see it, it's like Baroque. It's a Baroque stage set. It's like all the stuff. There's just a lot of this. And when I quit that and went to this, it was much more about, you know, more minimal. You had a horizon line, sky, water, pretty much. And I think, you know, these are portraits, but anytime, if you just put that on a black background, had that guy with it all black behind him, it would be quite a different picture.
Be Manet.
Yeah, there you go.
You want to go into Grassy
Lake? Yep, let's go. I think when an artist is trying to figure out what they're going to paint in their life, when you're trying to decide what your subject's going to be, for the first, I guess, I probably graduated in 78, so, you know, you're trying to figure out, you know, when I was at the Whitney program, I did video stuff and performance things. I did whatever they kind of wanted me to do, trying to learn. And the good thing about the Whitney is that twice, two or three times a week, we had a different artist. You know, it would be, you know, Alice Neal would come in, Alex Katz would come in, so you'd have those kind of guys. And then, you know, we'd have, Richard.
Sarah, yeah.
Richard Sarah and Bryce Martin. And so the deal is, and the thing is, they were so convincing. In New York, for me, I'm not, or at least at that time, not that strong about my convictions on things. And so when you had people say you shouldn't be painting, it's dead guys paint. That's not what we do here anymore. We moved on from that. And art history is not so, so important. We're kind of creating it. We are art history. And so when you have this pressure to move the ball down the field, the aesthetics, you know, the art ball down the field, it's a big pressure. And that kind of pressure and all the different people that came in, you know, were full of confidence and giant, huge cigars, and, you know, they knew exactly what they were doing. And I was like, every time I saw one, I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do. And then I see, so that's what I'm going to do. And the next guy, that's what I'm going to do. And every time I saw it, it was just, I'm just too weak. I'm just getting pulled into whatever anybody is convincingly tells me, and they're all, this is what they've spent their whole life doing. They're pretty convincing about it. And so that's when I felt like it'd be good to come home. But I didn't really know what I was going to do. And I did a few things like guys barbecuing in the backyard, which I was familiar with, and, you know, different things. But, you know, portraits, my teacher did a lot of portraits of his family. So my wife got victimized a lot, and I ended up painting a lot of self-portraits at the time. And our dog, you know, just whatever, just anything that would stand still, basically. And land as still lifes. And then a friend took me to this lake. And all of a sudden, for the first time, the place and the clumsy, heavy-handed, chunky way that I wanted to put paint on, you know, not blending and real thin like those ones from 1650 that Van Rysdale, but more just chunky stuff, like throwing it on there, smearing it around, seemed to be perfect for the subject. And I think that was the most important thing about the Grassy Lake thing, is that it really gave me the confidence to boldly go into something. And also being back home, you know, I didn't have anybody tell me you can't do that or you should do this, or really, you know, all the artists that were here in Texas at the time that, you know, Vernon Fisher and I were doing things here. You know, we all kind of kept to ourselves. If we saw each other, it would be somebody, you'd talk about anything but about painting or whatever you were doing. It just wouldn't come up, really. So it was like a sleeper cells. It was little sleeper cells of activity, you know. So we can't turn in the other guy because we don't even know what they're doing. You know, we're just doing nobody made a living around here as a artist, you know. I think nowadays people expect it when they go to school. I'm going to get out and be rich and famous. And, you know, it was something that you did because you had been either, for me, it was like I really couldn't do anything else, it turned out. I mean, fortunately, you know, really, it's kind of like this thing where you go, well, I like doing this. Yeah, but you're horrible at it. Well, I kind of like doing this, though. Yeah, you're horrible at that, too. Yeah, well, I could go sell cars. No, you couldn't. You know, it's like, dude, you want to buy this car? Come on. I ain't got all day. You want it or not? Let's go.
Okay, is anybody buying this? No.
So this was like, and as Terry said, you know, I could paint a picture like Ed Walker cleaning fish and a big bucket of guts and stuff at the bottom and not worry about selling it because I had a job. So it was a real freedom to be able to do these big, crazy-looking paintings, and I just wanted to. And the scale was my scale. You know, if this is on the ground, by the way, my studio was just 8-foot ceilings, so I could just wedge these. They're 8 feet. I could wedge them because the ceiling in my rent house at the time was not real straight, so I could just wedge it in there and start painting. That was my easel, was just, and I could reach 8 feet this way and about 6.5 feet this way. And the detail was huge. So instead of getting a tiny little brush and doing all that kind of stuff, you know, the detail's giant. So I like detail, but I didn't like the little brushes so much at that time. Later on, I kind of got into the little brushes. Those paintings in there.
As being landscape versus portrait, because you've talked about, I've heard you talk about, and that's what of course had me start looking at it this way, is because I'd heard you talk about being portraits of the place. When you were painting grass,
it's portraits. They're all portraits.
They're all portraits.
That's a portrait of that flower. You know, that's a portrait of nighttime at Grassy Lake. Uh-huh. That's a portrait of the winter at Grassy Lake. That's a portrait, of course, more traditional one of Ed Walker. That's a portrait of a night heron. They're all portraits to me.
Can you talk about
focusing on it?
Can you talk about Night Heron and the application of the paint and how that sort of led you to a transitioning?
Yeah. A troubadour. If you get a chance to look at this close up, a lot of this was, you know, it's all drawn. They're all drawn. There's drawings up there at the front that everything started from those little drawings like this. And I, you know, I didn't take pictures, obviously. I mean, if you've ever seen what a night heron looks like, that's pretty loose. That's pretty loose. They don't usually wear shorts, you know. But to me at the time, I thought, wow, that nailed it. That looks just like a night heron. You know, it's got the little things that they have, and the lily pads and the flowers. I mean, I love those things. And again, I wanted to make them, but I didn't want all that detail. So if they're this big, you know, that's pretty big detail. But the paint in it, the larger, at the time that I could get things, the more paint I could throw on it and still make it look real, you know, real, some form of realism. So if you look at any of this area in here, this big slab or that head, that face up there, it's like tar. It's just like gunked on there. Tons of paint just slathered on with my hands or with a knife or whatever and then drawn back through. So all this is like real thick white paint and then just lines drawn back into it. So it's kind of like carving. It's a very visceral kind of deal, and that place was so visceral. It was so much texture and so much going on. And so the earlier paintings, the very early ones like that one, you can see the difference. I think the only difference is that in that painting, I was so wanting you to see what Ed Walker looked like. And I really wanted you to be able to tell what he looks like. And that's the best I could do as a portrait at the time. And I remember showing it to Ed. They made a little poster of it at some point. And of course, he didn't know I did it. And I took him the portrait and showed it to him, and he went, "Well, you got the shoes right."
Hey, David, on the, you know, on Ed Walker, I have been seeing these paintings of Ed Walker for a very long time, and I thought for sure I'd recognize him on the street. And while the characteristics are there, he looked like a really big man in your paintings. And then when I saw pictures of him, he's not that large a man.
He's big. He seemed big.
Yeah.
And I think that's, again, the thing that you get from a photograph is the way. The way. So if you want to work from that, it's got to sort of be like this. But when you work from your memory and some drawings, then all that about how somebody appeared, all that, the feelings about, you know, the amount of emotion that they had comes out much bigger than you would have if it was real. You know, if it was right there. What you get if someone's sitting for you is, you know, people talk about auras and stuff. I don't know about auras, but, you'll have somebody sitting right there, and there's greens and blues and different colors. And you put, I mean, I'm seeing it. I don't know. I think it's pretty much there. Maybe it's a shadow or whatever, but I'm painting that stuff, and I get through with it, and I show it to you, and you're like, dude, you know. And another reason I've never painted too many women is because of that. You know, I mean, all of us, I'm just saying, all of us have had photographs taken, and we hate the photographs. It's a machine. It's not some dude extrapolating something. It's a machine. You know, well, that's a horrible machine. It's a crappy machine. So to try to get a likeness sometimes, for me, it's more about the painting. I think even Michelangelo said at one point about one of the Medici, somebody said, well, that doesn't look like him. And he says, well, I'm going to be dead, and he's going to be dead, and that's what he's going to look like. And the thing is, it's a painting. That's another really important thing that you have to realize. That more than a bird, you know, the thing that we're talking about here, like Sean's across the hall, you know, is that a picket fence? Is that some bricks or those rocks? No, dude, it's a painting. It's just a painting. And that's what this is. It's just a painting. It just happens to look a little bit like a bird.
Let's go move in. Since we talked about this painting, of course, I'm trying to use it to transition us in here to the sculptural pieces. Can you talk about this activity in this end of the gallery?
That one or the next room, either one. Both are good.
Maybe we'll go back and forth between them. Start
okay.
here.
All right. Maybe we can kind of get everybody in between or something.
If we could get you to keep moving, actually what I've asked David to talk about is the kind of marrying painting and sculpture. And so that takes place here and there. So he's going to talk about both while we stand here. So feel free to keep moving into that room. You're going to... You'll be able to hear him, and you'll see what he's talking about with that work as well.
The drawing that's right here, this is, again, how most of it just starts off with a black and white drawing. But sometimes it gets embellished a little bit more with some more lines and some color and stuff. But, the activity in a drawing, the desperateness of trying to make that image come to reality for you is there, and the desperateness to show you how white that bird's chest was is the amount of white paint that's on the painting. It's like, I'll figure it's whiter if there's more paint on there that's white. I also think that, you know, you get to have this child like 5 to 8 year old, you know, some of y'all, that age group is awesome. They're all geniuses. That stuff is all brilliant. I remember being in it, teaching a class, and everybody was doing this. I think it was 5 to 8. And they would want me to teach. And I was like, y'all just need to do that. That's where, if you can keep that up, that kind of freshness and that kind of non-tainted, violated by life, that would be awesome. And that kind of thing is what Picasso liked and Dubuffet liked and a lot of those different people. And I think that the freshness that you see in those kind of drawings is what you find in drawings. And what I try to do is to try to keep that freshness that's in drawings even in sculpture and in a painting. In this case, this sculpture was done first, and then that painting was done from the sculpture. So when you're trying to make a fresh sculpture, it's kind of, you know, you usually think of some guy with a big chunk of marble, and you're carving something out, and that's not so fresh, you know. Where this was just a bunch of boards, and it's kind of like the stuff you were in your dad's garage and he was making something, which I used to do, by the way, and you're just picking up all the scraps and like hammering them together and like, it's a boat. And by the way, at the other show over there, And this is one of those things that if I'd had some sort of highfalutin gallery, you know, it's like, well, your stuff's $10 million a painting. Yeah, dude, whatever, check this out. I just took a cardboard box and I cut some holes in it and it's a skull. And they'd be like, oh, dude, he just had a stroke or something. You know, you can't do that. You can't just take a cardboard box and, no, man, but you see, it's perfect. It's like trash. Now it's a skull.
How many of you have seen the skulls at the Nasher? They're pretty impressive, aren't they?
It's just, but it's just the moment, you know, that something happens in, and you could go, nah, don't do that. But that's that, you know, youngster kind of thing that you get to keep living through your work, and you can kill it off. I've known painters that are like, well, I was going to paint this painting of so-and-so and so-and-so, but then I thought that's not right. So I decided, and they just talk all the time, and they never get the thing done. Or they paint over and over and over and over a canvas, and it just, they could have been, you know, the Van Gogh show I was talking about, it's going to show like all these postmen, each one of those is a little bit different, and that's why he did it. It wasn't because he was selling them. I think, you know, these days people go, well, you knocked out a bunch of those beer bottles, I guess that was popular. I just wanted to play with it. I wanted to see where it was going to go next. I wanted to see it go from here to there to there to this, and just see all the different ways it could look. And if you're doing it from a photograph again, it's going to be that. And it could be awesome. I mean, I've never been able to do that. It's just been not patient enough to do that. But, and then this is on canvas, I think. So sometimes the canvas will be a part of it. The materials you use will pull more paint off your brush and get thicker. Sometimes if it's panel like this, you can carve around on it more, like that. And that becomes part of it. But all that is like sculpture to me. It's all the materials is part of that. Should we go in the next room?
Yeah, let's go look at snacks and then.
What's
paintings,
that?
The paintings.
Do they start off what?
Do you start off with black and white?
Drawing. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit in this room about the use of the snake, repeated motif of the snake, and of men and the idea of a dual portrait? You've talked a little bit about the fact that the portraits, you know, that those are portraits of Grassy Lake, that you're taking us to that place. And then you've also talked about when there's an animal and a person, two figures, that it's as much a portrait of the snake as it is the guy. Can you talk a little bit about your choice and maybe even what your response was when you walked in here and saw this room that's just devoted to man and snake?
Well, first off, this is the difference in the Dallas show, the Nasher, and the Fort Worth show. I mean, the paintings are, you know, they're finished paintings. And they're, you know, Jeremy Strict at the Nasher said, well, that kind of have like masterpieces. I'm only repeating it because I can't say that, but somebody else said that. So anyway, they're all finished and everything. You know, I think that's what he's talking about, where the sculptures look a little bit more not finished and a little bit more about the way it's done, the process of something. And these drawings were done for a piece that's over at the Nasher, big bronze. And again, they are about the making of it. The more you see the smudges and stuff, it's like, first thing that you learned in school was to not have smudges, those nasty smudges, we need to erase those. But the reason for snakes is not because not because I love or hate them. It is kind of because I hate them. But they're usually they're a great form. I mean, in Laocoon, the famous, Greco-Roman sculpture, they're great forms. But it's as much about struggle. The concept of a snake and the struggle of the snake and the struggle of this guy to hold it, the concept of nature and man again, and the vulnerability of the guy, you know, again, with this shirt and a snake. I mean, I usually do anything I can to get away from them, but I did note this is no mistake. You know, just in case things get out of hand, he does have a hammer. I mean, I'm not saying anything, but again, you know. But when I was there, the guys were building these docks, and this snake would go by. And I'm like going, oh, man, that is bad. You need to get out of there. And he'd just reach in there and grab the thing up. You mean this thing? And it was a giant water snake. I don't think it was a water moccasin, but I would have called it one. And that's just what he was used to. Wasn't a big deal for him. And the people who are around all these sharks and different people when we go out and fishing and all, we'll grab that stuff up, and it's not a big problem. Giant storms coming in, lightning hitting the water everywhere. They just like, you know, look at that a little bit, move over here in the boat a little bit, take a little bit of trip this way, let the storm go by, and we just continue our business. But for me, each time I see that, it's, again, that visceral kind of Hemingway. Whoa, this isn't good. We were out one time, and the rods, you have all these fishing rods, were all buzzing. And I'm like, dude, what's that sound? Is that something in your boat? He goes, yeah, it's those rods. And I went, what? I'm scared. What's going on? And he said, oh, that's just like static electricity connecting between that cloud and these rods. And I'm like, so I guess the real connection is when the lighting part hits and we're in an aluminum boat in the water. Can we go? You know, so... It's all that kind of stuff is I think tries to be in here, and I think the freshness that I was talking about, again, if you like order and you like, you know, sort of a Degas painting, although the Degas drawings look like that, but again, sometimes the making of it is so important to the artist that this thing is what I really love to see, that kind of freshness. I mean, that's probably not the best foot on earth, the best drawing of a foot, but that is the motion of the situation still there, maybe even more than that. That's the reason I do both, because I don't ever think that quite has it, so I go back and forth between the two. And then this over here, to me, is like... It's just paint. It's like the 3D paint, except it's sticks and boards and stuff done with a chainsaw and some scrap wood.
I really like how you do the plaid. You know, the fact, yeah, that plaid.
That shows up. There's a little bit of that over here in this drawing, too. That kind of just shows up, I think. You know, when you look back at, like, all Renaissance drawings and Durer and those guys, everything was made of crosshatching, you know. It was usually a little, not quite as coarse, a little bit finer. And it would define form and all that. So crosshatching has always been kind of a mainstay of all art. And for me, being a kind of traditionalist, you know, I've tried to do portraits, figure in landscape, you know, still lifes, you know, all the various classics. The classics of art history, like jazz standards. There's certain jazz standards that if you're a jazz musician, you have to play those songs. You have to know those things. And you just take those and do what you can to those. You take the standard, and then you torque it up a little bit for your game, for your way of doing things.
Before we started today, David and I were talking about the fact that it just sort of came to me with the show that he really is a romantic artist. I mean, he's what all of us, when we start out in art, it's what we expect from art, it's what we want from art. And then, you know, for some, you know, you feel like you have to leave that, and David's just stuck to it. And I think that's one of the reasons for such an enthusiastic response, because it means that everybody from the person who's never been to a museum walks in and sees this work, and either they relate to the subject because they've been to the Gulf Coast or they've been to some swampy area, they're responding to the paint on canvas, they're responding to all the things that they expect from art. So everybody from that person to, say, the critic, the art critic for the New York Times, Roberta Smith, who absolutely adores David's work. So you've got that full range. And, you know, him talking about going to see Van Gogh, that's just him in passing telling us that he's doing that. But I think that speaks to everything we're looking at. And it's so much about his practice. That's such a romantic notion to go and spend 2 days just doing nothing but looking at how Van Gogh handled this, and then getting out in the elements to experience that storm so that you paint that storm differently. And on that note, I'd like for us to walk in and talk about some storm paintings. I can be heard from anybody.
All right. The night scenes. There's a couple that are walking by right now. There's something about night that just brings out like the different colors of those guys' faces. For instance, in that boat down there at the end, somebody said those guys look dead, and. I think when I'm painting pictures of night, it's creepy, you know, sometimes out there on a jetty with a bunch of splashing water or in a boat, even if you're with very capable people, stuff can happen. And so it's also the death ship, you know, the guys on the searching, you know, in the Last Judgment, there's a boat with these guys that are raking souls out of the water. A lot of this has biblical backgrounds to it. The guy from the Biblical Arts Museum came by from in Dallas, and he was having a gold mine with this stuff. There was way more stuff that he said was in here than I knew was in here. But, you know, that's the three the guys, I thought that those lanterns looked like skulls. I mean, if you look, they've got little teeth and they've got eyes and, you know, they're supposed to be illuminating the way, but also they're the eyes looking at those fish, and the guys are trying to spear them. It's the same thing as all the Gulf Coast. It was the Gulf Coast producing food and a living for people. That's what it does at its best. So whether it's at night and things are kind of creepy and scary, or whether it's like the moon picture of the guy, again, I tried to make that guy as vulnerable and as timeless as possible, but one thing you can't escape when you're an artist is your time, the moment that you're in. And, you know, the work always looks like the time that you're in. The stuff from, you know, the 1940s and 50s, Picasso's things look very 40s and 50s. And if you look at, you know, every different period has that look to it. And so, you know, I think that it's there regardless of you know, how you try to disguise it. You just try to work with what you have. And I think for me, you know, somebody said, what style would you call this? And I think the idea for me is that it was a culmination of all the inabilities that I have more than it was some ability. It was like, you're not really good at the precision of the anatomical study of a figure, you know, like that guy, he's got some funky action going on. But it makes it more expressive in terms of what he's trying to do. And that wasn't necessarily intentional, it just was fortunate that that's how I happened to mess things up. And we're in a time period where that's okay. Because if we'd been in a time period where that, like if I'm in the Renaissance right now and we're making those paintings, I'm not going to make it as an artist.
But doesn't that reference an art historical? I mean, I don't think it like initially referenced it, but and I can't bring up the artist.
There's a Goya pose. There's a Goya with a crazy house, a madhouse, and there's a guy in the snut room, and there's a pose like that. And then the other room, there's a crab painting, and then, you know, it's a wild looking painting of some suffering individuals. And But I tried to get that kind of, you know, the mystery of when you have a line, a big line like that, usually those guys will have a big, huge hook with some kind of meat on it, and they throw it out in the water, and some shark will get on it, and they'll just wrestle them in.
Oh, my God.
They'll just wrestle it in. And you don't know what's out there. But if it's a big, huge hook and it's a giant chunk of meat, it's probably going to be something bad. And so when you got a guy on a little rock like that that's slippery with all these waves coming over it,
seriously,
and he's fighting something like that coming in the out of that ocean, you have no idea. It's just the mystery of the sea. So I love that kind of concept of that. It's very poetic. And, you know, yeah, it's pretty romantic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Really old school. I mean, nowadays I think, you know, when you have your iPad and all that, everything moves. It's all moving. And so when you look at art now, you know, I think artists that were brought up with that, they want their work to move and flash and do things and say stuff and have noise and communicate. And, you know, I'm wondering if, in time whether still paintings on a wall, you know, when you go look at those paintings at the Kimball from, you know, the 1400s, if how much you have to work. You have to do some work. You can't just walk by and it starts talking to you about, this is Lazarus, just got brought back from death, you know.
But don't you think that, for one thing, we know it's cyclical in terms of popular appeal. I mean, the paintings stay good. They don't stop being good.
Well, we hope.
But, well, they do. you know, that you can't say that anything over at the Kimball has fallen out of fashion that's still good. We may, popular opinion may have more or less, you know, interest in it at periods, during periods of time. But I think that's part of the appeal I was talking about. That is part of the romance of your practice.
I think if you went to a gallery in New York and said, I'd sure like to show here, and they said, what does your work look like? And you said, seascapes. they would escort you out.
I think we're in a moment. I would actually debate that, because I think we're in a moment right now where we want evidence of hand. We're a little tired of irony. I think this exhibition is popular in terms of it's been very well attended and there's been a lot of conversation because it's good work. And I also think it's because we're in a time where I think this is something we really kind of need. Could you talk about the painting over there of the...
This little one?
Yeah.
This is like, of all the paintings, I think, and that, you know, it's really hard for me to determine, because there's so many paintings and I have so many different reasons for liking them all. You know, it's like your children. This whole thing is like your kids. And you're getting them to come back for a reunion. And some of them, I guarantee you, my kids have had a lot better life than I have. Some of them live in some pretty nice abodes. You know, I'll be hearing from the various owners. It's like, wait, how about this? When it showed up, the painting from the Met shows up in this box that I could live in. You could shoot that thing from New York out of a cannon and it would have gotten here safely. I mean, it was very stoutly built. It had lamps and everything in there, music to keep it company, a butler, you know. Anyway, she undoes the thing and she pulls the painting out, has these people all doing it, and she's going over the whole painting with a grid to make sure nothing had happened during transit. And you know, we haven't been introduced or anything, and I walk over and I'm looking at it, you know, and I kind of go over to the edge of it and I go like that, and she goes, who are you? This is mine. She goes, no, it's mine. Who are you? And I went, I kind of painted it. Oh. Well, you're not supposed to do that. That's not good. Let me do that. Oh, and there was a couple of guys that had these little, they're like turkey baster-like things. And it's like going, and that's what they're getting the dust off the paintings with. I'm like, wow, you got a paintbrush? Because I can just do that. I know how much to press on this. Believe it or not, I kind of have a feel for it. And but when people buy things or when museums get things, what happens, and I've had this happen for me, I've done a body of work, some people bought it, two or three of a certain thing that I did, and I decided I didn't like them. I didn't like that group. So I threw all the rest of them. Once they came back from the show, threw all the rest of them away. Turns out that was a mistake. But, because some of them are in the show. But the thing is, the people who saved those, they saved those from me. They are the custodians of those things, and the museums are through time. You know, everybody just has them for a little while. You know, me, you know, and another thing I have to, as artist, I think, you know, I mean, I'm, again, another old school thing, but this is like grave markers. You know, these are like things that you do, and they're going to outlast you, and they're going to be speaking for you in the future. You don't want a lot of crappy tombstones. You know, the reason I destroyed those things is I didn't know if I liked them, and so I just, I don't know about those. And, you know, and I've done a lot of times where they did need to be destroyed, but those did not need to be destroyed so much. And I've made some mistakes on that. But anyway, this painting, what I like about this painting is, finally, after all this time, I was able to do a painting smaller and still have the control of the paint without it getting just, you know, like a de Kooning. But because you get smaller, the paint would get, the scale brings that giant paint stuff way smaller and closer to you. So now when you do some, this right here was a, after painting for a while, you get a lot of paint that didn't work, a lot of stuff you mixed up that didn't work. And so I scrape that up like this, and I put it on a paper towel, and I just about throw it away, and I go, it's like a pie. You know, it's some good-looking colors. It has all this striated stuff. And I thought, you know what? That's going to look windier and more cloudy, I bet, if I just put that on there like that. And it worked that time. You know, that is, if you couldn't build the whole painting like that. But what I'm telling you is that it's just every little moment and every little thing you do. You know, my teacher always used to say, you should make every brush stroke. There shouldn't be brush strokes that aren't doing anything. Well, I don't know, that's kind of bold, but in this one, all that chaos in there, I think, was a struggle to try to make that look like that sky. And do you have to do that? No, but I had to do that because it's the best I could do. And it ended up looking like wind and rain and that kind of look. That is made. This thing is actual. It's at Bolivar in just out of Galveston, and it's a Civil War cast iron. Lighthouse that they almost took down to turn into cannonballs, but the war was over before that, or Texas part of it was. And but it has that feel to me of what that that cast iron looks like. So again, the thing that that somebody like Van Gogh would have for me, here's a guy that is he painted those things in an afternoon, by the way. You know, the guy was a genius, but he had a sense of line and a sense of color, and he would go experience something. The best example I can tell you is I had a magnolia one time in the room, smelling like a magnolia, oil paint smelling like oil paint, all these smells and all the stuff, leaf stuff starting to fall off, those magnolias change really quick, and I'm slathering paint around. That whole thing was so romantic. I mean, it is like you just want to have candles burning and some Gregorian chant or something. I don't know. I mean, but it was so rich of an experience. And to be able to, that's your job. That's a cool job.
Can we go in and talk about the relationship between the Katrina paintings and the Gulf Coast paintings?
Caught your language.
I did see. Are y'all out? Oh, where's the picture going? All right, let's get them here. All right, girls. Did we get it?
Ladybug soccer. Okay.
All right. Do good at soccer.
Thank you.
This room, I don't know if it's because it's the biggest, most dramatic room, or I've seen so many, you know, great shows in this museum, and they all, this room always looks different in every one of them. You know, again, you know, this room has had a whole Guston show in it, and it's had a, you know, a Freud show in it. I mean, there's a lot of great painting shows that I've seen in here. So for me, just to be in the same, I remember the painting from the Freud show of that guy with the pants with the stripe, red stripe on him. To have that painting in there, and again, when Michael was saying, "We'll put this painting there," I'm like, "Oh no, he needs a red stripe on those pants or something." But it worked out. It was an awesome job of hanging this room. And to have the coast when it's being productive and things are working out great on these walls, and then to have it when it goes the opposite direction, what it did for me is it made these look more important and more and stronger, and it made these look not so tragic, not so, you know, hard. Although the topic of Katrina, you know, I mean, at the time that that happened, Terry said, "You didn't have a choice." What it was it you told me? You said, "You did, these just happened."
It's like these paintings just insisted on being painted. You just were a conduit almost. You didn't have an option.
I was drawing pictures from the TV coverage as it was happening, and making little paintings within a day or so, just little ones of the various, of these people's faces. I mean, the amount of struggle and strength and anger and frustration was, it's kind of like Grassy Lake for me. It was such a strong vision that even if you did a bad job, it would still look pretty strong. I mean, even if you didn't do a very good job, it's still going to look pretty strong.
But these are really good paintings.
Well, there was a lot of reasons not to do them. Again, if you think that this is going to look good in your kitchen, you know, it's not about that. It was about something that had gone terribly wrong, and I just felt obliged to try to cover that, to try to do something that had something to do with the city that I'd loved. I'd been going down there for, you know, 25, 30 years. And at the time that this happened, it was, I knew people down there. I knew what was all was going on. And I you know, followed it by calling them and trying to do that. I tried to go down there. You couldn't do that. Finally, Arthur Roger got me into the city. The water had gone down by that point. But it was really easy to see where the water was because there was a big brown line. And there's been lots of writing and songs and poetry about that line. But you could really tell, I mean, the houses were made out of cypress. And they were on big cypress blocks or concrete blocks. And so when that levee broke, it was like a little tidal wave came up in there. And everything was low, you know, sometimes 20 feet below the level of those levees. And when it came in there, it would take one of those cypress houses and just pick it up like a boat, and it would just surf it into the next house and the next house and the next house. And if there was a brick house in there, they all just got jammed up on that. So there were houses in the middle of the street, houses with trucks underneath them, and there was a famous photograph of a truck upside down under a house. There were tons of cars because cars, they knew it was going to be a storm. I mean, the thing is, everybody ignores them because you have a million storms through there. For 50 years, you'll have storms. And you know, they say, okay, everybody must get out of here. So you get out, and then some people break into your house and stuff. You're like, man, I should have stayed. I shouldn't have left. Or you just finally just don't go. But you rolled your windows up. You know it was going to be some rain and stuff. Well, what happened is those cars, the engine's heavy, and the cars are full of air in the trunk, so the whole car just floats up off the ground like that, like a cork. And you'd have whole stacks of cars that would be in the current, like a fence of cars all lined up like that. It was amazing kind of You know, a lot of artists did pictures of various different mayhem that happened because of it. But one thing that I saw happening because of the everybody being piled up at the Superdome or the convention center is that I realized that this is a really volatile, odd situation, that you have all these people being brought to this very small area, and then what? There's no water, there's no food or anything. So then indiscriminately, people were just getting put in buses finally after a week and sent somewhere. They didn't know where they were going. You just end up in Arkansas or you end up in Tennessee. Your family, hopefully some of them were on the bus with you, but not necessarily. So everything was just crazy. But by the time about 8 days, 9 days was over, that place was empty. Only thing in there now is armed guards, you know, the National Guard, soldiers, and a few people that were hanging around trying to figure out what was going on, or that actually stayed. That's, I don't ever know, I've never seen anything like that in my life. And so when you see that, this form of reporting is all I know how to do. And so I tried to do, again, as good a portrait as I could possibly do. I'm not like a classic portrait painter, but I tried to do the best job I could do that would show, you know, the emotions that I saw. And again, paintings don't ever cut it. You know, what it really needed was a movie or a film, you know, that would show that. And there were some. But for painting, I tried to do the best job I could.
But you captured it. You definitely captured it with these paintings. And I know that you did get some, you know, just a little blowback on, are you sure that's kind of a sensitive subject to be painting? But, you know, and maybe even as big a fan as I am of you, I would have thought, don't do it, you know?
Right.
But when I saw these paintings, and the first time, I have to say, the first time I saw them was when they hung here, thought, I believe this. I believe this 100%. These paintings are real. And, yeah, I think you set out to make paintings that I see in the other rooms, and they're good for that reason. These paintings set out for you to make them, and they're good for that reason. Can we talk a little bit about mortality and flowers?
Yep.
You saw this on television.
She said you saw this on television, yep.
Then did you get in your car and go down?
You couldn't get down there for about 2 months. They wouldn't let anybody in. I didn't go for about, let's see, it happened in right at the beginning of October. I probably went in December, end of December.
So you did these from television?
I did the first drawings, and most of the things I saw were from photographs or television, which, I, by the way, I always told my students never to paint from television, to go look at it, which, of course, I usually can do. But in this case, they made everybody go because they were shooting people who were just walking around. If you were just hanging out, you probably got arrested. And there were controlled lines to get in and out of the city, like barricades. And my buddy was running. He was a barricade runner. He lived there, and he was just running through barricades. He'd go to one if they wouldn't let him in. He'd show a bunch of credentials, and they'd let him in a different one. So he got me in, finally. But you couldn't go in there.
It was 2 months before you got
in. Yeah. Yeah, it was October, November. It was about 2 months. It took some time. There you go. So September, October, November.
It's important stuff.
Sure.
I think your subconscious is building the painting.
What I love about the still life paintings is the way that David's able to just, I mean, they're sitting still, unlike anything else that we've seen up to this point, you know. So he's able to just really analyze his subject and look at it forwards and backwards. But what I also am compelled by, and it's come out more in conversation than necessarily my observation or it occurring to me, is that his subject matter is in the process of dying. You know, it's not going to last forever. There is a time frame here that he has to work within. So that's one of the things I want him to talk to you about in this room. Can you do that?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
I'm sorry.
Sorry, I wasn't paying attention.
I know, it's hard. It's hard to be so loved. But I was just talking about the still lives and the fact that it's kind of the first time that we're seeing in these paintings that your subject isn't moving around on you. You know?
Right. Another thing about the still lives is that a thing that Michael Opping, you know, there's the various different people who've been who have a good eye on different things. I've tried to get them to come through the show and look at it with me. And one of the things that, you know, you have traditional flowers in a vase kind of thing, like these sunflowers. That is probably the most traditional. And then this is sunflowers in a vase too, but it's just made out of wood. So the reason that you would do sunflowers so many times is because it changes so many times, or dogwood so many times, or magnolias, is it changes all the time. But Michael was saying that he liked the idea that he put the beer and cigarettes in there as a still life, because it are in some of the paintings where you had a bunch of boxes of shrimp and a couple of beers and some hooks and stuff like that, and it was still a still life, but you just, you know, you're so used to seeing a traditional still life that even that makes it a little bit more interesting and tells, it's like a portrait without the person being there. There was a Hartley, Marston Hartley, at the one of the museums around here. Yeah, it's not there anymore. There's a reason I was tempted not to mention it. But anyway, it was a pair of gloves and a hat. And it was an incredible painting, and I used to come all the way over here just to see that painting. And it was as close to being a portrait without a person as you could possibly get. And that's a really cool still life when that happens, when you get the essence of a person.
Can you talk about the one down here being sort of a family portrait?
Yeah, well, the picture on the wall is supposed to be me, but I tell you what, when you get to be, I don't know whether some of you might have experienced this, but you look up one day and you're acting and looking just like your dad. Sometimes that's really cool, but my dad was a wild ass character, so I'm starting to kind of get used to it, but he looked like that without this, you know, so really, that's a family portrait because it's got both me and him in it. And I remember when he was really sick and dying, the people that were taking care of him at the hospital, I came in one time, and he was a mess. And I came in, and they said, "Oh, look." And I went, "What?" And they said, "You look just like him." And I'm like, "God, not just like him, come on." But anyway, it's my dad, it's me, and then the collection of antique chairs and stuff is my wife loves furniture and antiques, and so that chair is something that she would have collected, and she would much rather me paint her chair than her. There's been some paintings of her, but you know, again, she's a sport about it by now. But they're kind of rough sometimes. But there's a drawing here, and then the painting, and then the actual thing, and then a painting of that.
To me, that really does represent what we were talking about, that romantic practice. I mean, you are in so many of the self-portraits, I see that too. It's a painting of you painting. It's a painting of what you paint. It's a painting of, it's a drawing that leads to the painting. You know, it just, maybe we can move into the self-portraits because we're kind of out of time, and I want to.
Yeah, I think the self-portraits happened more after the passing of my parents. I think when you're a little younger, when I was younger, it's always more fun to victimize other people. I think the work when I was way younger, when I was in school, was really, and I see this in lots of kids, and it's just a natural thing, is very tough on everybody. It's like a young comedian. It's like, you don't care. You don't have anything to lose. There's nobody going to not hire you. They're not hiring you now. So you just say whatever you want to say, and you do whatever you want to do, and you're as mean as you want to be. And after a while, I think you develop the fact of being more loving about your work, more respectful about your life choice and your friends. And I think at the passing of my parents, you know, you realize that, you know, I was the only kid and they were only kids. So when my parents passed on, it was like, batter up. You know, you're it. You're next up to bat. Okay. You know, and they both died within the same year. And so that was a big year. It was 98. So you can see a change in the work around 98, particularly over at the show in Dallas. It gets very dark. And there was lots of black, just black sculptures, not painted sculptures. And the snake figure was done in that time period. And there was a few hands that were done and drawings of hands. And somebody said they loved this work. They thought this work was so strong and powerful. And I said, yeah, dude, but like, not for me. It's like really killing me. You know, and I know that that in art, that's really, you can get some really powerful stuff from really bad times. But for the person who's in the middle of it, you know, finally I realized I was just doing paintings of my hands. You went from looking at the world and amazing, you know, nautical scenes and all this, you know, beauty of life to, and I thought, you better change this around. And actually, I had a friend of mine that said that they would cut me some irises from their garden. And they said, these irises are like my kids. I wouldn't cut these for anybody. But I think you might be able to do something with these. Just paint me a picture of my kids. And they put them in a vase, and that was a really helpful turnaround for me because I just painted them, and the painting kind of brought me back to some, you know, something that was there before. But that kind of made these kind of happen. So you have ones that start with reading glasses, and then they kind of creep up on my nose. And there's some there that one there with the... with the all the little drawings on the wall, and then there's another drawing on the table. That's again how this whole thing happens. There's drawings, and then the way it turns out.
Seems like a really nice place to close. Thank you so much, David.
Oh yeah.